The elementary school that my younger brother and I attended was originally built in the 1920s. It was a rural school. It was built out in the country. Over the years, our hometown grew and the student population zoned for that elementary school increased. More buildings were built around the original building. But there was a problem. Although the student population increased and the buildings increased, the school's sewage system was not increased to match the student population. As I said, the school was built outside the city limits, and so it was not connected to city water and sewage. The building had field lines, drain pipes that take the wastewater away from the buildings into the ground, and if all goes well, the sewage water, the wastewater, just dissipates into the earth. Unless you have more elementary school students than your building can hold. And so the pipes in my elementary school were somewhat overwhelmed, and well, just to be honest about it, raw sewage bubbled up onto the playground. So my younger brother and I would come home with our socks and shoes and pants legs wet and stained from raw sewage. This went on for a while until my mother decided that she really needed to do something about that. And so she made an appointment with the principal. And she explained that the kids were coming home covered in raw sewage and that needed to be corrected. And the principal, who was a family friend and a member of our church, smiled and nodded and said he understood, but he really didn't have the budget in the school's, the dollars in the school's budget to correct that, and she should talk to the district administration. And so my mom made an appointment with the assistant superintendent for facilities, who was a family friend who went to our church, who smiled and nodded, but said he didn't really have the dollars in his facilities budget to do anything about it. She should talk to the superintendent. And so my mom made an appointment with the superintendent, who is a family friend and a member of our church, who smiled and nodded and said the school district was growing so much, while he understood her concerns, he really didn't have any dollars in the budget to do anything about it. She should talk to the school board. So one day, when I was in the fifth grade, I had a doctor's appointment with our doctor, who was a family friend, who went to our church, and who was a member of the school board. So mother picked me up at school, signed me out at the office, and told me before I got in the car, we needed to do something. And she pulled out of her purse a mason jar. And we walked down to the playground, and she scooped up the sewage water, the wastewater that was bubbling up from the playground, and she tucked that jar into her purse. I was an astute fifth grader, and I knew that something interesting was afoot. So we went to the doctor's appointment, and the doctor gave me a shot or a physical or whatever it was that I needed on that particular day. And then at the end of the appointment, as we were sitting in his office, he said, as he always did, "Is there anything else?" And my mom said, "As a matter of fact, there is." And she pulled the mason jar full of wastewater, unsanitary, unhealthy water, out of her purse. And she explained the problem to him, that sewage was bubbling up on the kids' playground. And he smiled, and he nodded, and he explained that the school district was growing and there really just were not the dollars in the budget to tend to all of these problems. And my mother said, "I understand that. I've talked to the principal and the assistant superintendent for facilities and the superintendent, and now I'm talking to you, and something needs to be done." And he again explained, there simply were not dollars in the budget to fix this problem. And she said to him, "I understand that. So what I will do, I will take this jar of wastewater that's bubbling up on the kids' playground to a lab and have it analyzed. And then I'll take the results to our local news station." And he looked at my mother and said, "Give me 24 hours." And the next week, miracle of miracles, construction started on our playground. Tomorrow will be my mother's 80th birthday. As I've mentioned, she lives with Parkinson's these days, a form of Parkinson's that has also visited her with some Parkinson's-based dementia, and she has some other health troubles. It kind of takes two people to lift her in and out of bed now. She's largely confined to a wheelchair and sometimes can't even feed herself. And that makes me sad. Sad not because she's dealing with this illness. She is not a complainer and would not want anyone to be sad simply because she has an illness. But it makes me sad because the world is missing out on this courageous spirit, this crusading soul. Now, my mother is not perfect. She would not want you to think she is perfect. She would only want you to think that her children are perfect. But she's no longer able to march into a school board member's office with a jar of raw sewage and say, "Fix this." And that makes me sad. The world is missing out on that purposeful sense of righteousness. I've thought about that as I've thought about her birthday and the traits the world no longer has because she is not as able to be as fully participatory as she once was. And as I've thought about that, it dawned on me, aha, as those moments happen, Mom may not be able to do those things, but I can. And my sisters, my sister and my brothers and our children, we can do those things because we bear that same sense of curious engagement in our bones. People pass on all kinds of things. China, real estate, cash, and DNA. My DNA is from my mother and my father. I did not spring up fully grown, independent on my own. None of us did. We do not get here by ourselves. We do not exist on our own. I am here because biologically, my parents live in me. For good or for ill, I am part of them because they are part of me. My parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, just like those names, those complicated names we read from the Bible, I am here bearing in my bones the very stuff of Amanda and Robert and Mary and Benjamin and Isabel and Samuel and another Mary and William and Carlene and James and Lily and another Robert and Mary Bell and Sid. They are a part of me in real, biological, substantial ways. So I've been preaching for a few weeks about the Exodus story. You know the plot. The Hebrew people are slaves in Egypt, and God calls on Moses to free the slaves. God tells Moses to go to Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go." And it is a grand, dramatic, powerful, plot-driven story until you get to the part we read this morning where the writer says, "But hang on a minute, before we figure out what happens, let me tell you all of Moses' ancestors' names." What a buzzkill for a story, right? He shows up at Pharaoh's palace to say, "Let my people go," and then we have to suffer through all these names that Nancy suffered through with us this morning. Levi, Merari, Mushi, Amram, Jochebed, Phinehas. Except there's something important in there. Just as important as my parents and grandparents and great-grandparents are to me, and your families are to you, so are Moses' ancestors to him. He did not show up fully formed, independent, on his own. He showed up at Pharaoh's palace bearing in his bones the DNA of his people. Now, we don't know much about these names. We don't know much about Levi or Amram or Jochebed. We don't know the details of their lives. But one of my favorite writers says we are invited to read the Bible with holy imagination. We're invited to read the Bible with holy imagination. So here's what I imagine as we hear that list of names. I like to imagine that Levi was a devout, faithful soul who believed in a big, inclusive God. And I like to imagine that Amram, Moses' grandfather, was a kind, gentle man who lived with grace and respect for everyone. And I like to imagine that Jochebed, Moses' mother, was a passionate, fiery soul who worked for justice and equality. And I like to imagine that when Moses showed up at Pharaoh's palace to say, "Let my people go," he did not show up alone. He showed up with the echo of his ancestors singing in his soul. He bore in his bones the DNA of faithfulness and inclusivity. I like to imagine that the nucleotides of Moses' biopolymer strands were not only filled with adenine and thymine, but they were also infused with grace and respect. And I like to imagine that the genetic structure of Moses' being was not just a coiled double helix, but it was bound together by coiled cords of kindness and justice. We are the inheritors of those who came before us. For good or for ill, the DNA of our ancestors is in our bones. The DNA of our ancestors is in our organizations, it's in our institutions, it's in our body politic. As Americans, we inherited from our ancestors racism, patriarchy, and we must learn what it's like to excise those tumors from our body. And we must nurture and nourish the subparticles of decency and dignity that are part of our DNA as well. We must tend to the good inheritance of our very beings. Here, in this place, in this congregation, we have inherited a DNA. This congregation was founded largely by abolitionists, this group of people who had fought in the Civil War and worked to free slaves, and then moved to Washington after the Civil War to see that equality became the law of the land. Those are our ancestors. Now, it's easy to say, really, there are enough troubles today. Who cares about the people who were here 130 years ago? But I care. I care because our DNA is that of liberation. It helps me know how I am to live every day because we bear freedom in our bones. In the 1960s, this congregation said, "We are going to work for equal housing for all people of every race as part of the civil rights movement." Now, some people may say, "But things are bad now. Who cares what happened 50 years ago?" But I care. I care because I know that the building blocks of our congregation are justice and equality, and they shape who we are every morning when we wake up and face the world. In 1999, this congregation voted to be open and affirming to people of all sexual orientations. That inclusivity and compassion, those things are subunits of our being. And so when we are faced with the worries and woes of today, we don't have to wonder who we are. We know who we are. We are people who inherited kindness and justice, and they are coiled together within our congregation to create the molecules of our existence. These things are written on our bones. Today is a day to say goodbye. Janet Hoffmeister, who is a member of our choir, who has played the piano for us, who directs the bell choir, who has served as a deacon, and who coordinated our acolytes for years, who worked in our church office, Janet Hoffmeister is moving to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, to be near her daughter and son-in-law and grandchild. And that is a splendid decision on your part, except it really stinks too. The good news is we'll see you from time to time. Janet Hoffmeister is part of our DNA. Her love for music, her care for acolytes. By the way, how many of you have been acolytes or your children were acolytes while Janet was the acolyte coordinator? Those of you who haven't had the experience need to know that almost by the time you get home from church, if your child is an acolyte, by the time you get home, Janet will have sent you an email to tell you how wonderful your children are. That's a part of our DNA. Like cytosine or guanine is part of our bodies, you are a part of our congregational composition. Today is also a day to say thank you. The other Janet, Janet Moyer, as we have said, is retiring after 15 years as our membership coordinator. For many of you, maybe for most of you, Janet has been the first face of the congregation as she welcomed you on Sunday morning, as she connected you to someone else in the congregation, as she oriented you through our new member process. Janet has done so many things. In fact, I'm just going to say Janet has done everything. I don't know if she's preached, but we probably should have had her preach today. She nurtured our affinity groups, she's edited the newsletter, she maintains the church role, she takes care of the church directories, she coordinated the phone bank when we were doing the equal rights work. I've seen her sweeping and toting boxes and wiping down the pews. Just out of curiosity, how many of you on a Sunday morning have been welcomed into Westmoreland by Janet Moyer? That's about what I thought. Another question, how many of you have ever had a phone call or an email from Janet just to check up on something or tend to some? Yeah. That hospitality, that caring, that passion for this community is in our church body. Your gifts are part of our DNA. Thank you. In a moment, we will share communion. Take, eat, this is my body. Those are the traditional words of communion. Early on in Christian history, others accused the Christians of being cannibals eating Jesus. What is that all about? It is a strange theology that we don't always buy into, except that it makes sense on a certain level. The early church, in trying to remember Jesus, came up with this symbol, this ritual of saying that you can actually take Jesus and make Jesus part of your being. You can digest this very love that he exhibited. You can make him part of your DNA. And so when we celebrate communion, we're not just eating a bit of bread or drinking a bit of juice, we're also remembering that this love-infused way of being is part and parcel of who we are as Jesus followers in the world. We'll sing a hymn in a moment, a hymn that was written by Ruth Duck. She actually wrote it for a family reunion. The first words that we will sing, God, we thank you for our people, roots dug deep within the soil, hardy spirits rich in loving, story for struggle, bold, strong for struggle, bold for toil. And so on this day, I give thanks for the names that are written on our bones. I give thanks for elementary school parents who lead mason jar revolutions. I give thanks for the liberating power that Moses bore in his bones when he confronted Pharaoh. I give thanks for the DNA of justice that is a part of this congregation. I give thanks for the DNA that we inherit from Janet and from Janet to help us be the people we are called to be. Ruth Duck ends her hymn writing, "Bind us close to one another, sharing life and death and birth, welcoming as sister, brother, all your children on the earth." May it be so with us. Amen.